Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California.
We learned today the economy has been growing for 3 straight years now. Sure doesn't feel like it, does it? From American Public Media, this is Marketplace.
Balance your life with dollar signs. Tune into Marketplace Money this weekend for a look at the issues affecting your wallet. Whether it's investing, renting an apartment, or sending your kid off to college, we'll help you navigate.
From the Frank Stanton Studios in Los Angeles, I'm Kai Rizdahl. Happy Friday, everybody. This is the Marketplace Podcast for the 26th of October. Good to have you with us. So listen, for those who believe this election hangs on the American economy, today was pretty much it. The last A-list indicator we're going to get before Election Day, gross domestic product, that is the size of the economy, grew at an annualized rate of 2% last quarter, which is not all that great, but it's better than nothing. Here to help us sort it all out in our weekly wrap of Wall Street and Beyond are John Carney from CNBC. He's in our New York studios. Also, Neela Richardson from Bloomberg Government down in Washington, D.C. Hey, guys.
Hi. Hello.
Hey, so John, what do you think? 2% better than nothing, but what?
I'll take it. You know, 2% isn't that bad. I think we were on the verge of entering something, a more serious recession. It looks like, at least for the time being, we have avoided that. You know, it would be great to be growing faster, but 2% is better than nothing.
That's funny. I was totally going to think you were going to go the other way. But all right, Neela, what do you say? 2%?
Well, it's funny to look at what's driving that 2%. It was really the surge in federal spending, particularly defense spending.
Yep.
And that spending was maybe driven in part because the agency is concerned about the fiscal cliff. It's trying to get all of its spending and contracting in now before perhaps automatic spending cuts take place next year. So we're seeing a little uncertainty play into these numbers this time around.
That's why we have Washington on the show, so we can talk fiscal cliff, because that stuff actually matters. Hey, John, so let me ask you, just on the topic of that stuff actually matters. Is GDP what we ought to be looking at as we think about this economy?
No. I think that what we really need to pay attention to is the jobs that our fellow Americans don't have. Unemployment is way too high. What we need to do is start thinking about, even if we had tremendous job or tremendous GDP growth, if we're not creating the jobs that are keeping Americans employed, we're actually impoverishing our future. People are not going to develop the skills they need to be able to work in the future. This situation has gone on for way too long, and that's the metric we all need to think about.
Neela, let me use that as a pivot to the next point I want to bring up with you guys, which is corporate profits, which have not been great, tech specifically, Google and Apple and all that. I mean, if companies are feeling not great, what then can consumers derive out of that?
Well, consumers can derive a couple of things, especially in the tech sector. One of the reasons why these companies haven't been doing so well is they've been competing so much with each other. And out of that, what we're getting is all these great new products. But when you invest in products as a company, margins are much, much narrower. And so while we can benefit from the iPad mini and all these great other things that are coming our way, you know, the tech sector is going to suffer as a result of that investment.
John, talk to me, dude. What do you think about corporate profits?
I think corporate profits are probably going to face a serious hurdle in 2013. We've had pretty profitable companies for the last couple of years, but in particular, the tech companies like Apple. When was the last time Apple really came up with something innovative? Their big new Hoopla is the iPad, but just smaller. Hmm. And I think some of these companies have been running on innovations that they made earlier. Apple has now started paying out a dividend, partly because they don't know what to do with all their money. They're no longer the innovative company they used to be. The iPad is just a very big iPhone. The iPhone was a revolutionary device. Ever since then, we're just getting bigger and smaller versions of it. I don't think that's going to portend well for their profits.
All right, dude. I'll tell you what. I'm going to step aside because you are sure to be hit by lightning. I'm just saying. Criticize Apple. You know how it goes.
Heresy to criticize Apple.
I'm going to just say I don't even think Apple is a tech company anymore.
I think
they're now, you know, they're a phone company.
But quickly, you look at its stock chart today. It closed at $604. That's off $100 in like 3 weeks, John.
Yeah, and I think one of the reasons is that investors are realizing that there aren't a lot of brand new, really exciting ideas coming out of Apple. Yeah. It is still up, though, for the year by a lot. I think something like 50%.
Right.
So losing a couple points here and there for Apple, you know, maybe not the biggest deal.
Yeah, fair point. Quickly, before I let you go, Neela, are you guys battening down the hatches for the storm?
Absolutely. We're getting all of our peanut butter and crackers lined up.
You know, that's peanut butter coming up late in the broadcast, as it happens. Neela Richardson from Bloomberg Government down in Washington. John Carney from CNBC in New York. See you guys. Have a good weekend.
Thanks
you
a lot.
Too.
All right. Be good. GDP, Schmidp, there was something going on Wall Street today the traders did not like. We will have the details when we do the numbers. All right, no offense to John and Neela intended, but all you people in the Northeast, you need to stop with the goofy storm names. I mean, Frankenstorm? Come on, will you? But second of all, this one is going to be a biggie. It's serious. The second year in a row, the Northeast is going to take a direct hit during Halloween week, and it's the second year in a row of enormous and costly messes to clean up. From New York, Sally Herships has that story.
To see how utilities are preparing for Sandy, or Frankenstorm, let's begin in New Jersey, where PSE&G, which provides power to the Garden State, is busy.
How many interviews have you done today?
Oh, I can't keep track at this point. Quite a few.
Karen Johnson, PSE&G spokesperson. Johnson says together, last year, Alfred and Irene cost the utility over $1 billion in repairs and new equipment. So, to prepare for Sandy, PSE&G is turning its eye skyward, sort of.
You know, unfortunately, a lot of the trees that were planted many, many years ago are not compatible with power lines.
Which is why Johnson says this year, PSE&G has spent about $28 million just on trimming branches. Connecticut Light and Power passed on an interview. Instead, I spoke with Christine Sherdon, a Farmington, Connecticut resident. She knows all about trees. During Winter Storm Alfred, a branch fell on her car.
We were without power for 11 days.
Sherdon says she and her husband lost all the food in their refrigerator and their big freezer. Their insurance company reimbursed them, but not enough to cover the cost of the 50 pounds of venison her husband was storing. So, in preparation for Sandy...
So we are not filling up our freezer. We're not filling up our refrigerator. We're going to live with what we have here.
But sometimes you have to get extra support. Both New York City's Con Edison and PSE&G are bringing in repair crews from out of state. In New York, I'm Sally Herships for Marketplace.
On the topic of presidential candidates, as we so often seem to be these days, anybody out there remember Wesley Clark? The retired Army four-star ran for the Democratic nomination back in 2004. Didn't do all that well. He only won Oklahoma. But he's been busy since as a consultant, a cable news pundit, and this past summer, a reality television host, if you can believe that. Now, though, he's working on an ambitious coal project in Kosovo, where he once ran the NATO campaign against Slobodan Milosevic. Nate Tabak has that story.
Six trucks are parked in an intersection in Kosovo's capital, Pristina. They're filled with coal, mostly used to heat homes. Behram Maloku is offering 1 ton for 50 euros, or about $65. He'll squeeze out a small profit, if he's lucky.
10 euros go to gas every day, 3 euros for food. If I don't sell anything, that means I lose 13 euros. In 3 days, my profit's gone.
Kosovo is sitting on lots of coal. Unfortunately, it's lignite, which is the lowest grade. It takes a lot of lignite to generate the same energy as regular coal. So most of the coal in Kosovo ends up like this, on a roadside conveyor toward a pair of outdated power plants, and doing little for the economy of Europe's second poorest country. But not if Wesley Clark has anything to say about it.
Well, thank you very much. Thank you.
The retired U.S. Army general was in Pristina last week for a gala held in his honor.
I'm really happy to be back in Kosovo.
Wesley Clark is a hero to Kosovo's Albanian majority. As the NATO Supreme Allied Commander, he helped to end Slobodan Milosevic's brutal crackdown 13 years ago. It paved the way for Kosovo's independence from Serbia in 2008. Naturally, Clark shared a few war stories about his confrontations with Milosevic.
And I said, Mr. President, if you don't pull those forces out, NATO's going to tell me to bomb you, and I'm going to bomb you good.
Now Clark, the businessman, has ambitious plans for Kosovo and its coal. Clark chairs a Canadian energy company called Invidity. It wants to tap into Kosovo's underground coal deposits to make synthetic fuel for cars and planes. Kosovo's government would get 30% of the profits. I talked with Clark about the coal project as he chowed down on dinner in his hotel suite.
And I hope we can do it here, because if we can, it'll make a huge difference for the country.
A huge difference in a country where unemployment is 45%. The average salary is less than $6,000 per year.
You could bring in hundreds of millions, maybe even billions of dollars worth of foreign direct investment.
Clark's company has a rough plan. Drill deep into a coal deposit to extract gas. The gas then goes back to a plant at the surface, where it's converted into liquid fuel. The process has a long history, but it's never really taken off.
It's just like fracking or anything else. It's not easy.
Clark does say Invidity's method is safe for the environment.
It's a totally green process. Except, of course, you're going to use a fossilized carbon. But that's the way we make liquid fuel right now.
But Nazir Sinani is concerned that Clark's project doubles down on dirty lignite when the country should pursue renewable energy. Sinani is acting director of Pristina's Institute for Policy Development.
Turning coal into liquid means producing something which is damaging to the environment, and we need to see how that will be dealt with.
Kosovo's government so far appears eager to make Wesley Clark's project possible. And there's a good chance the public will give Clark the benefit of the doubt. The former NATO commander's name alone carries a lot of weight here. Just ask Valdit Drnovsi. He owns a Wesley Clark driving school.
Taking into consideration the war, what we went through, and the help that he gave us, when the name Wesley Clark is mentioned, it automatically means a force, a big name.
Drnovsi says the name has attracted a lot of customers over the years. Wesley Clark, for his part, says his coal project in Kosovo will hinge on its substance, not his personality. In Pristina, I'm Nate Tabak for Marketplace.
We've got slideshows from Kosovo and of General Clark, if you forgot what he looks like, at marketplace.org. Coming up, you want to know why there's only one Silicon Valley?
One of the things that the Valley has that's really, really distinctive is this extraordinary tolerance of risk and failure.
So that's why. But Chicago is going to give it a shot. First, though, let's do the numbers. TGIF, baby. The market's wrapped up a week of sluggish earnings reports, as we were talking about at the top of the show. The Dow Industrials gained 3 points. Yeah, we're going to call that flat, 13,107. The NASDAQ inched up a point, also flat, 2987. The S&P 500 dropped a point. We'll call that, flat, 1411. For the week, the Dow Industrial's off 1.8%. The NASDAQ off 0.6%. The S&P 500 down 1.5%. Today, Apple sliced off almost 1% after reported weaker-than-expected earnings. Blame iPad sales that missed Wall Street projections. Also, blame John Carney. Go ahead. Goodyear Tire deflated more than 10% on news of lower profits. The financial sector also lagged today. Citigroup off 2%. Bond prices rose. The yield on the 10-year T-note fell to 1.75%. And you are listening to Marketplace.
Marketplace covers the world of economics. Are you ready for some Freakonomics? We're partnering with the team that writes about the hidden side of everything for a regular Marketplace Freakonomics story, podcast, and more. Just go to FreakonomicsRadio.com.
From the Marketplace Datebook, here's a glance at events coming up Monday. A look at how much we earned and how much left our wallets in September. The Labor Department reports on personal income and spending. It's the anniversary of Black Tuesday, the day the stock market crashed in 1929, launching the Great Depression. And here's something much less depressing. It's National Cat Day, encouraging folks to visit a shelter and adopt a new kitty. Organizers have a Facebook page. I should warn you, it's covered in fur. I'm Michelle Phillippe.
This is Marketplace from APM. I'm Kai Rizdal. All right, so consider the business dilemma the New York Times confronts today. Its online edition has been shut out of the biggest market on the planet. NYTimes.com is very much offline in mainland China. It's what happens when you report out a story in meticulous and documented detail, saying the number two official in that whole country and his whole family have been on the take for years. Of course, the Times doesn't do its journalism just for profits, but still, a couple of hundred million lost page views ain't nothing. From Shanghai, Marketplace's Rob Schmitz has more.
It only took a little over 2 hours for Chinese authorities to block the New York Times website inside China after its story first appeared this morning. And according to Beijing-based Chinese media critic Jeremy Goldkorn, it may take weeks for the site to come back. But that doesn't mean the Chinese won't read the story.
Chinese is a global language, and Chinese communities across the world, including the United States, are also a market. But it will certainly hurt them here.
But Goldkorn doesn't think the New York Times site was meant to be a big revenue generator for the company.
As long as they're aware of that, that block or no block, it's not going to be a cash cow for quite some time to come. They should be able to just keep their eye on the long-term future.
That's what Bloomberg keeps telling itself. Its site has been blocked inside China for 4 months thanks to a story it published about the family fortune of Xi Jinping, China's presumed next president. Beijing-based law professor Stan Abrams isn't sure the risk is worth it. After all, says Abrams, both stories didn't really show the Chinese people something they didn't already know.
I think the average person on the street here would say, yeah, we knew that.
Still, for China's government, the New York Times report couldn't have been directed at a more vulnerable official. The premier is affectionately called Grandpa Wen by the Chinese. He's seen as one of the least corrupt political leaders. And China's censors are doing whatever they can at this point to maintain that image. In Shanghai, I'm Rob Schmitz for Marketplace.
Here's a random and somewhat metaphysical question. What makes an American car? I ask because next week will be 30 years since Honda started building cars in this country. The 1983 Accord, which rolled off a Honda assembly line in Ohio. Toyota and Nissan soon followed, not only making cars, but eventually designing and engineering them here as well. So back to the question, just what makes a car an American car? Dan Bobkoff has that.
Here is just how global the auto industry has become. Chrysler is majority owned by Fiat in Italy. GM is selling a Buick Regal designed in Germany, and Toyota markets its Tundra pickup as the red, white, and blueiest.
It's designed in Newport Beach in California, and it's built in the heart of truck country in San Antonio, Texas.
Someone in southern Texas, that's their patriotic truck.
Sean McElinden is chief economist at the Center for Automotive Research. He says GM now builds more cars outside the U.S. than here at home.
You know, the U.S. market is not going to be important in the long-run fortunes of General Motors or Ford.
Not so for Honda, which is becoming more American, says Honda spokesperson Ron Litsky.
Honda produces more automobiles in this region of the world, which is North America, than any other region of the world.
More than they make in Japan. Honda even exports 100,000 of those cars designed and built in the U.S. to Asia and elsewhere. So if you're wondering what makes a car American, economist Sean McElinden says it's complicated.
Well, some people would say it's the ownership of the company. Others would say it's the domestic content or the amount of, let's say, employment and income that Americans receive from the sale of a car.
And if you go by Cars.com's formula, four of the top five most American cars are made by Toyota and Honda. In New York, I'm Dan Bobkoff from Marketplace.
You got your Silicon Valley, you got your Route 128 outside Boston, you got Northern Virginia and New York to some degree, and now you got Chicago. The city is making a big push to become another hub of high tech, drawing key companies to set up shop, or at least trying to hold on to the tech whizzes it grows at home. Chicago's not going to get any points for its weather, so it's trying other ways to reach out to the next generation of tech entrepreneurs. From the Education Desk at WYPR, Marketplace's Amy Scott reports.
Chicago is just a couple hours' drive from one of the best schools in the country for computer science and engineering, the University of Illinois at Urbana-Champaign. But students like Brianna Berman, Nathan Handler, and Dylan Nugent are often drawn to other shores.
I guess in the past few years, Chicago hasn't really been on the map in terms of the tech industry.
So far, it looks like a lot of the jobs are in the Silicon Valley, California area.
A lot of the jobs appear to be in the West Coast right now.
Earlier this month, the mayor of Chicago, Rahm Emanuel, made a pilgrimage of sorts down to Urbana to change their minds. He brought with him executives from 39 technology companies, including local success stories like Groupon and Grubhub. I sat down with Emanuel in his office after the trip.
This is a state university that the Chicago taxpayers help finance. I don't want to have help finance their education. And then they leave for the coast.
Chicago is haunted by the big ideas that got away. Mark Andreessen, the co-founder of Netscape and one of the biggest venture capitalists in the world, was a University of Illinois grad. Founders of YouTube, PayPal, and Yelp also studied there before heading west.
Talent is what draws companies. Well, I want to draw the talent here, and the companies will follow.
So how does a city draw talent? For starters, it needs a place for them to stretch out and try new ideas. Like Chicago's legendary Merchandise Mart, a massive building of showrooms and shops that's becoming a new technology hub. Motorola Mobility, just bought by Google, is moving in with 3,000 employees.
The Merchandise Mart is the second largest building in the country by square footage. Number one is the Pentagon. You can look it up on Wikipedia.
Kevin Willer is CEO of the Chicagoland Entrepreneurial Center. In May, the nonprofit group launched a new startup space in the Mart called 1871, a nod to the period of innovation after the Great Chicago Fire. It's got all the standard tech accessories, high-end coffee shop, arcade games, workers whiz by on scooters. 100 startups now share office space. There are workshops and meetings with mentors.
The hope is that they move in, plug into all kinds of, you know, resources and connections, and then move out. That's success. Hopefully, if they're leaving because they're going to get their own office.
So far, one company has made that move after raising a round of capital. Chicago's getting more of that, too. Just an L stop away from the Merchandise Mart is Lightbank, a venture capital firm run by the co-founders of Groupon.
What you see here is a number of different companies that are in their early stages that are getting off the ground.
Co-founder Brad Keywell made a fortune taking companies like Groupon and Echo Global Logistics public.
We've invested in, I think, 53 companies right now after only 18 months. And that is the most critical thing for a great technologist to find when they are considering their careers.
But engineering a great startup culture takes more than money and talent. Margaret O'Mara teaches history at the University of Washington and writes about the global quest to create the next Silicon Valley.
One of the things that the Valley has that's really, really distinctive is this extraordinary tolerance of risk and failure. That kind of culture you don't see in a place like Chicago. Chicago is more conservative.
But O'Mara says Chicago will also need enough successes to convince budding entrepreneurs and investors that betting on the city is worth the risk. In Chicago, I'm Amy Scott for Marketplace.
Dig down into that GDP report this morning and you find this tidbit. The drought this summer cost us 0.4% worth of overall economic growth last quarter. The Midwest, as we all know, got walloped. The southeast part of the country, though, largely escaped the hot and the dry, which you'll appreciate when you get down the peanut butter aisle at your local grocery store. Our senior business correspondent Bob Moon reports.
We interrupt months of bad news about the drought for this important message from peanut farmers throughout the South.
Peanuts and peanut butter because we're drowned in a sea of them right now.
Don Kaler heads the Georgia Peanut Commission. He says improved growing conditions and more planting have brought a banner harvest.
It's by far the best crop that I've seen in 26 years as executive director of the Georgia Peanut Commission.
Kaler says farmers are already fetching significantly lower prices, and by some estimates, retail prices could fall by 10 to as much as 30%. That would be especially good news for food banks across the country, which favor high-protein items like peanut butter that they can keep on their shelves. Still, at the Rhode Island Community Food Bank, Andrew Schiff worries that retail prices have been, well, sticky so far.
In general, donations of peanut butter I don't expect to go up significantly because it still remains expensive.
At the American Peanut Council outside Washington, Patrick Archer says it may take some time for the price break to reach consumers.
as peanuts being harvested at the moment start moving into the food supply later this year and into 2013, I think you'll start seeing moderation in peanut and peanut butter prices on the supermarket shelves.
With wholesale prices already half of what they were last year, Georgia peanut farmer Armin Morris worries about too much of a good thing.
I don't particularly want us to have a surplus to drive the prices down to a level that the producer can't make a profit.
Then, though, he mentions the other farmers who didn't fare so well this year and tells me, we were blessed. I'm Bob Moon for Marketplace.
Marketplace is produced in association with the University of Southern California's Annenberg School for Communication and Journalism.
This final note today found in the financial disclosures section of the Federal Election Commission website. Between them, President Obama, Governor Romney, and their parties are just shy, and I do mean just shy, of raising $2 billion collectively to win the White House. They'll get there by Election Day, and that's not even counting super PACs. We did get to counting, though, all the other things you could do with $2 billion. You could buy more than 3 million shares of Apple, if you like. 3,311,258 at the close today, to be exact. You could get most of the way to Mars. The new rover up there costs $2.5 billion. Or you could remake and market Disney's epic flop John Carter 5.3 times.
John Carter!
John Carter!
John Carter!
John Carter!
John Carter!
John Carter!
5.3. Get it? Yeah, we got a little slap happy at the end of the day. All right, we got to go. That's Marketplace from APM. Today, the Dow. Today, the whole market, actually. Just flat. Our theme music was composed by BJ Lederman. Marketplace is produced by Sitar Nieves. The executive producer of the broadcast is Deborah Clark. JJ Yore is the vice president and general manager. Coming up this weekend on our personal finance show, Marketplace Money, fine dining no matter the budget.
There is an immense amount of pleasure to be gotten from a $500 seafood meal at Providence, and there's an amazing amount of pleasure to be gotten from a $1.50 taco in East Los Angeles.
I'm Kai Rizdal. We'll see you Monday. And this is APM.
All over the country,
we need to improve reading in Wisconsin.
Schools are changing the way they teach reading.
I'm calling for a renewed focus on literacy.
We have gotten this wrong in New York and all across the nation.
And it's happening because of a podcast.
I think your podcast has changed my life.
And I'm going to share this podcast with everyone I meet.
Sold a Story investigates how teaching kids to read went wrong. New episodes of Sold a Story are available now.